Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Nilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
After all the rishis and others had seated themselves comfortably, the king, humbly standing before them with folded hands, told them of his decision to fast until death. Purport. Although the king had already decided to fast until death on the bank of the Ganges, he humbly expressed his decision to elicit the opinions of the great authorities present there. Any decision, however important, should be confirmed by some authority. That makes the matter perfect. That means that the monarchs who ruled the earth in those days were not irresponsible dictators. They scrupulously followed the authoritative decisions of the saints and sages in terms of Vedic injunction. Maharaj Parikshit, as a perfect king, followed the principles by consulting the authorities even up to the last days of his life. Maharaj Parikshit is sitting on the bank of the Ganga, Ganges, having received news that he is to die within 7 days. And all the great rishis and other great personalities of the universe arrive. Parikshit Maharaj decided to fast until the moment when he was destined to leave this world. So his fasting, it didn't hasten his death. He wasn't really fasting until death, but he knew his death was coming and he decided to fast. Exactly why is not explained, but it can be understood that anyway, if the body is going to die, then why try to maintain it? And why try to enjoy with it? And eventually then he was listening to Srimad Bhagavatam, and he didn't want to eat or sleep because he was so absorbed in hearing that message. So this is his decision. He'd already decided that, and he told that to the assembled rishis. He didn't expect any opposition from them, but he told them, and Srila Prabhupada comments in the purport that it's a decision that he took, but it should be confirmed. So if any of the rishis had any objection to that or further suggestion, they could have given him advice, because after all, Maharaj Parikshit, even though he is a pure devotee of Krishna, and actually it will be seen from the very fact that Shukadev spoke the Srimad Bhagavatam specifically to him and only secondarily to others, that Maharaj Parikshit from the outset was more advanced than most of the rishis who were present. His understanding that life is meant for Krishna consciousness, that his firm and clear understanding of this made him more advanced than the rishis. But in terms of knowledge of Shastra, presumably they may have been more advanced, because the king, he was a king, and his energy went into ruling, whereas the rishis, they were fully devoted to direct spiritual culture. And apart from that, the etiquette of not just doing something in the presence of advanced and learned saintly people, then it is proper, especially for one who is a subordinate, to not just to make some decision, but to express that to the higher authorities with the expectation of getting their blessing or getting their correction or their further instruction. So Parikshit socially was inferior or subordinate to the rishis present, who are mostly brahmanas. The rishis and others present. And Maharaj Parikshit was a kshatriya. So he very properly expressed his decision. And Srila Prabhupada writes, any decision, however important, should be confirmed by some authority. That makes the matter perfect. And Srila Prabhupada points out that the monarchs who ruled the world previously, they weren't dictators, but they would execute the orders of the various brahmanas who were their advisors. And the brahmanas, generally there'd be a council, and there may be some senior most person, but they would discuss among themselves and then advise the king accordingly. So it wasn't exactly, although it was monarchy, and in one sense the king was absolute, but in another he wasn't bound to, but he would generally follow the orders of his advisors. Therefore, it was understood that the king, it was not just his own personal qualifications that made him a great king, but he had to have good advisors also, because even if one is a good king and capable, but if he has bad advisors, then he cannot rule properly. And even if there are good advisors, but the king is not capable, then again things won't go properly. So it's something like a guru-disciple relationship. If the guru is capable and proper of advising, and the disciple is proper, both have to be suitable. And then the result, which is that the disciple becomes enlightened in spiritual knowledge, then the result takes place. as Srila Prabhupada gave the example, that if a man is potent and the wife is fertile, then, and the season is correct for their union, then a child will result. There are certain conditions which have to be there. There should be a man and a woman. Not that a man and a man can produce a child, or a woman and a woman. It has to be a man and a woman. So there has to be a guru and a disciple. They have clearly demarcated roles. And they both have to be properly acting in their roles. And there are also considerations, other considerations, the favorable circumstances. Favorable circumstances, specifically the time during the month, which is favorable for fertilization of the embryo, and or not of the embryo, of the womb. And there are other considerations also. The mental state of the two parties and so on. So the relationship between the brahmanas and the kshatriyas is it's like that of guru to disciple. The kings, although they had a lot of freedom in what they did, and they also, there might be conflicting opinions among their ministers, in which they, or they themselves may not be able to decide. They may say, well, you can do this, or you can do that. If you do this, there'll be these pros and these cons, and if you do that, there'll be these pros and these cons, and both are according to dharma, and you may decide. That may also be there. But the king has some measure of independence and some measure of dependence. And that's true of the disciple also. We often hear about the disciple shouldn't be so independent. But to some extent, he has to be also, because that is the very nature of the living being, to be largely dependent. We're dependent on the arrangement of God for air, water, food, the very body that we have. Thank you. I have, but you can give it if you like. Thank you very much. The very body that we presently inhabit, for light, for rain, we're dependent in so many ways. But at the same time, the jiva, especially in the human form of life, has the independence to choose to act in various ways. And even the higher levels of human life, there's more independence. So the disciple, by all means, should be dependent. Otherwise, there's no meaning to be a disciple. Disciple means discipline. Shishya is the Sanskrit word. It comes from the shash dhatu, which, same thing, it expresses discipline. So he should be under discipline. One who does not accept the discipline of the guru, then even if he formally takes initiation, then he's not really a disciple. Disciple and devotee, these two words are almost synonymous, because to be a devotee, one has to be a disciple, and one becomes a disciple so that one can become a devotee of Krishna. Sometimes we say devotees of Srila Prabhupada. Well, one should be devoted to the guru, no doubt. But really, the center of devotion is Krishna. One becomes a disciple of a guru so one can become a devotee of Krishna. So although the words are almost interchangeable, there's a difference in emphasis. Devotee means a devotee of Krishna. He's also supposed to be devoted to the guru. And disciple means who is committed in relationship to a guru. And although one may be a disciple in a non-Vaishnav sampradaya, or may be a disciple for even non-religious or spiritual activities, just like Duryodhana became the disciple of Balaram for learning how to fight with a club. The Pandavas, they were disciples of Drona. He's called Drona Acharya. He's not an Acharya in teaching spiritual knowledge. He's an Acharya in teaching how to fight and everything which is connected with that. But really, disciple means that, in the full sense of the term, means that one should be trained in becoming a devotee of Krishna. A Vaishnava guru nasyad Vaishnava svapacho guru hu. Because guru means devotee of Krishna, whatever background he's from. And even if one is highly learned in Vedic knowledge, if he's not a devotee of Krishna, he's not fit to be a guru in the full and true sense of the term. So a devotee should be a disciple. A disciple should be disciplined. He should live according to the directions of the guru. These are straightforward points. There is a misconception quite prevalent in our ISKCON society in the West, especially, that previously disciples always used to live with their gurus, and this idea of gurus just coming around once a year or every so often, that's just something new and modern. It's a misconception. Disciples live with the guru in the gurukul as brahmacharis, as young boys, aged from about 7 up till 21, 25, like that. And then they may go away and they may never see their guru again in that lifetime. We don't have any record of Krishna and Balaram again seeing Sandipani Muni after studying with him. But generally, at least in this Kali Yuga, the gurus live in their own village if they're grihasthas. I'm talking about gurus in the Vaishnav sampradayas. Or they may live in a mutt if they're sannyasis, an ashram. And the grihasthas may be scattered here and there, grihastha disciples. They may come and visit the ashram. Or the guru may go out every so often to visit his disciples in various places. Sripad Ramanujacharya, he traveled all over. Shankaracharya also, they traveled widely. Madhvacharya also, they traveled widely. Shankara, he initiated followers, but he brought many of them back with him and trained them and then sent them out again. Ramanuja initiated widely, which is why we find the Ramanuja Sampradaya, although it's concentrated in certain areas of South India, but there are, the Ramanuja Sampradaya is spread very widely in North India, Nepal also. We find in the description of Madhavendrapuri that he was traveling, he came to the house of Advaita Acharya, who requested Madhavendra to give him initiation, which Madhavendra did. And then Madhavendra went on, and there's no record of him ever coming back again. So the idea that the disciple always lives with the guru, that was the previous model, and nowadays it's all messed up. It's not like that. It was previously most, especially for... grihasthas, they might not see their guru regularly, all the time. But they take instruction. The acharyas, they mostly write books also, which give instruction on how to live one's daily life, what to understand from Shastra. So those who live directly with the guru, it should be easy for them to understand what is wanted, and for the grihasthas also what's wanted, because life doesn't have to be very complex. In the Varnashram society, what does one do in one's day-to-day life? Well, it's all mapped out by many, many rules of Varnashram. And what to do, for instance, getting married and all these things, having children. Well, the spiritual initiating guru, they wouldn't be involved in this generally. But the family elders, the village elders, they're also gurus, and not in the fully spiritual sense usually. Or they might not be, but they will give direction in all these things. So one is always under the direction of gurus, but it might not be always the... And not for everything those who are giving spiritual direction. And after all, the acharyas who are giving spiritual direction, they may also not want to get involved in all the day-to-day details of the grihastha's life, which again may not be so very complex that they need so many instructions. In the modern age, it's become very complex because people don't like to follow many rules. They think, well, if you follow rules, it becomes too complex. But actually, it's round the other way, because if the rules are there, everything is clear and straightforward. Everyone knows what to do. But if there are no rules, then no one knows what to do, and there's room for exploitation and speculation and so much confusion. Instead of, for instance, in matters of marriage, instead of it all being set up so the spouse, the spouses-to-be don't have to worry about. They have to they personally throw their emotions into it all, and they get completely on the emotional platform, and then they suffer when they fall in love, and then they fall out of love, and then they fall in and out, and in and out of love again and again with different people, and then they become skeptical of the whole thing, and in between they have the children here and there. The whole thing's a mess. So one should act depending on the Vedic instructions as they are received from gurus, both the directly spiritual gurus and those who are instructing in the Vedic social way of life. And in this way, one remains dependent. And if there's a decision to be made, then one will confirm that with others, generally in the families. Family means joint family. Nowadays, what is called family, it's being redefined as Kali Yuga goes on. Family used to mean joint family with several generations living together, and then it became the nuclear family, and now it's the man plus child, or woman plus child, or just the woman plus three children from different fathers. And as Kali Yuga goes on, the concept of family changes, not for the better. But really, family means that there's the head of the family, the elders, and then within the village there are elders, and in this way everyone works under authority. And there may not be that many decisions to be taken. If life is very simple, there are not many decisions to be taken. For instance, you might want to decide, I have an offer of a good job on the other side of the world, so should I go or not? But in Vedic culture, there's no such thing. Mostly people stay the place they're born in, they live in, and they die in. That's all. They may go to die in some holy place. Life is more simple. There are not so many decisions to be taken. Decisions mostly have to be taken by kshatriyas under the guidance of brahmanas who advise others which decisions to take. The major decisions in life are arranging the marriages of children. Otherwise, there may not be that much to be decided. As society becomes more disturbed, then decisions have to be taken. For instance, if there is even in a village, if there's fighting going on between the kshatriyas, they don't bother. There are descriptions of in one field the kshatriyas are fighting, in the next field the man is plowing the field, because he knows they have a fixed place to fight. They're not going to kill me, and whoever wins, I have to give them a certain amount of the crop. That's all. So he doesn't bother. They're doing their business, and I'm doing my business. But then if you hear of some Muslim invaders are coming, and then they're coming this way, okay, then they all have to make a quick decision. Are we going to stay, or are we going to leave? And if you have to leave, then you don't get much time to you have to decide what to leave behind and all this. If society is stable, then there's not so much tension of all these decisions to make. Everything fixed like that. So much percentage of the crop you have to give to the king, and that's all. You do your work well, and whatever amount of the crop comes, you give it. That's all. So life is very simple in that regard. As far as living directly with the guru, there are some who do that. Some may be personal servants. Or live in the ashram, same ashram with him, his base. They may live throughout their life, or they may be sent out also for preaching or for establishing other marts. Some become, they may be very intimate personal servants, for instance. Ishwarapuri served his guru Madhavendra Puri. At the last stage of life, Madhavendra Puri enacted the pastime of deep sickness. He was bedridden, and he would pass stool and urine in the bed, and Ishwarapuri would clean that up. In this way, he served him very intimately. There are some devotees who they just completely commit themselves to serving their guru. Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj had his servant Bihari Das Babaji, and Bihari, his only service was to care for Jagannath Das Babaji. He would carry Babaji Maharaj around. If Babaji Maharaj wanted to go somewhere, then Bihari was very big and strong, and Jagannath Das at that time was very old, and his body was very thin. Jagannath Das would sit in a basket, and Bihari would carry him on his head and take him from place to place. And whatever Jagannath Babaji said, then Bihari would do, that's all. And there was daily routine, so he knew what to do. Govinda was the personal servant of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Actually, there was one Govinda in Navadvip who was a servant, and then there was another one later who became the servant, who was also a disciple of Ishwarapuri. So generally, the godbrother won't become the servant, but because Ishwarapuri ordered that, then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted. So Govinda's service was to see his own spiritual life wasn't his concern, how he's chanting, how Govinda himself, how he's chanting and doing his sadhana. His whole sadhana, his bhajan, everything was just arranging for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That's all. And then, of course, he may have chanted some rounds here and there, but his first duty, not just to see what is to be done. And Govinda would supervise others also, who are also engaged in various matters of personal service, especially Ramai and Nandai. They would bring water, there were others also. Vaninath Patnaik, he was also engaged in some personal service when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in Puri. Govinda got left behind when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went out of Puri, and then he would take some other servant with him at that time. But the only service is serving and not getting involved in the personal matters. The personal matters and decisions, and that was for others. Sarup Damodar would, and especially Sarup Damodar, Ramananda Rai, especially Sarup Damodar, he would act with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is. Sarup Damodar would, in personal matters, in how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is, people are coming to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they want to talk to him, making arrangements for going here, and Govinda would arrange on a different level, but Sarup Damodar would make decisions, who can come to meet Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, like this. There are other servants also. Kashishva would, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would go to the temple, there'd be so many crowds of people and they'd all want to come and see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and they'd be crushing in on him, and Kashishva would go ahead and just push them out of the way. That was one of his services. Our own... in our own ISKCON, there was one devotee. His name was Anirdeshavapu. Anirdeshavapu, yeah. And now he's Bhakti Vidyapurna Maharaj. But before he took sannyas, his service was serving sannyasis. And that's what he did. He would cook, clean. He was very expert in doing everything in a very pakka way. And quietly, unobtrusively. And among themselves, they would discuss so many matters in front of him with the understanding that he didn't really even listen to all that, because it's thinking that, well, that's on a higher level. They're discussing all important matters about ISKCON management and this and that. And even if he heard anything, but he wouldn't say that to anyone. He was completely reliable in that regard. So that was his whole. He also learned to play mridanga expertly, and so many things. He learned so many points of Vaishnava culture, so he could serve better. But his whole mood was just, I'm here to facilitate the service of those who are doing important service. And it came as a bit of a surprise, maybe more to him than anyone else, when he was nominated for sannyas, because his whole mood was simply how to be the servant of the sannyasis. But then it was considered that he was very capable and qualified, so he was awarded that. So a very intimate service. In that situation, then you just, again and again, you'd be told, do this, do that, now arrange this, and have to adjust in different situations and understand what to do. Sometimes get chastised because things don't always go right all the time. So that's a very safe situation if one is directly in the shelter of the guru. Of course, familiarity can breed contempt also. Srila Prabhupada also warned about that. Ishvara Puri, even though he was so familiar with Madhavendra Puri that he was personally cleaning up the stool and urine, by which someone might come to think, well, he's just an ordinary person. His body is incapacitated. He's passing stool and urine. They may come to have the mundane conception of the guru. He appears to be suffering pain and so many things. But another disciple, supposed to be disciple of Madhavendra Puri, was Ramachandra Puri, who was so foolish that he thought that he would instruct Madhavendra Puri. And the result of that faithful service of Ishvara Puri was that he was given the service of becoming the guru of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Who can initiate Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is the guru of all the worlds? But Ishvara Puri had that role to play in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's lila, because he was such an ideal disciple that he was given the mercy to become the guru of he who can have no guru unless he accepts out of his own desire. And Ramachandra Puri, by displeasing taking a position as if he was in a position to instruct his own guru, then as a result, he also got direct association with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but instead of utilizing that opportunity for spiritual advancement, he simply tried to find fault with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, how one deals with devotees, and especially with seniors and advanced devotees, it affects one's own vastly affects one's own spiritual consciousness and progress. As can be seen, Ishwarapuri and Ramachandrapuri, they both had the same opportunity, but one took it properly and became fully advanced, and the other misused it and just completely made a mess of his own spiritual life. So the so in Vedic culture, we hear, for instance, in Vedic culture, Srila Prabhupada often quoted from Manu, Nastriyam Swatantram Arhati. It is not proper that women should be independent. But actually in Vedic culture, no one is independent. The Brahmanas, they have a broader measure of independence. They have some measure, because it's understood they won't misuse that. But if they do misuse it, the king cannot punish them, but the Brahmana community can punish them. And the worst punishment is to be excommunicated from the Brahmana caste, and then or the Brahmana society, and then one has no position. Then he's no longer a Brahmana. Then he has to become a Chandal. That's the, but they're in various ways. The Brahmanas, they're self-regulating. But they have much independence. There's no rules for them, because automatically they live a pure life. They're supposed to have no motive to exploit others, so they're not going to be sinful. So everyone is dependent. Everyone is disciplined. And especially when one becomes a disciple, one voluntarily accepts more discipline. And in the Vedic Shastra, it said that everyone has to become initiated. Otherwise, you're like an animal, because animals don't have the opportunity to be initiated. There are some rare cases, but generally initiation is for the human. So if that is, if one doesn't do that, that means one is not properly utilizing one's human form of life. So one is said to be just like an animal if he remains uninitiated. That means one has to be always under direction, under guidance. But again, there will be some level of independence. One has to, the guidance given is so that, not that one becomes a robot, but one knows how to act in all circumstances. It's not possible in all circumstances that one can take personal guidance, nor is it desirable that a devotee for every little thing has to take advice from the guru and confirmation. Srila Prabhupada explained that every time he wanted to pass urine when he was a little boy, he would ask his mother for permission. So that way he felt very dependent, but it would be strange if as an adult he would still be asking his mother. One is supposed to grow up. But sometimes in major decisions, I'm discussing this point, how Srila Prabhupada has written, any decision, however important, should be confirmed by some authority. But sometimes that's not possible, because sometimes one has to make a major decision and there's no authority to consult. A great example is that of Hanuman, who has completely surrendered to Lord Ram, who, after going to Lanka, he burned the city. His mandate was to find Sita. He did that. But having found her, and finding himself in the with the opportunity, he thought, well, okay, he offered Sita, you come with me, I'll carry you back. And she said, no, that's for Rama to do. He has to rescue me, not you. So Hanuman said, okay, but Hanuman thought, well, let me at least do some initial spying work and find out, because if you do some reconnaissance work before any battle, that's very useful. And in the course, Hanuman was caught, and he's understood he was a spy of Rama, so then they set his tail on fire, and Hanuman expanded his body, and with that burning tail, he burned the city of Lanka. So that was a decision taken. He did that independently. He didn't say, well, before you set my tail on fire, let me just jump back and ask Ram, and then I'll come back again and burn your city. There was no. He either had to do it then or not do it. And afterwards he lamented, because he said, well, I could have burned Sita also. I just didn't think of that. But he took a decision independently, and he's glorified for that up to the present day, that he did more than his prescribed mandate in the service of Lord Ram, exhibiting his anger against and disdain of Ravana. He burned the city of Lanka, of which Ravana was so proud. There was no one there to confirm with. There was no one to ask, should I do it or shouldn't I do it? So he took the decision himself. He was independently thoughtful. Srila Prabhupada used that term. He wanted devotees to be independently thoughtful. That doesn't mean that they're not dependent upon the orders of the guru, but they can use their own intelligence to apply that those principles which they've learned from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Another great example is Srila Prabhupada, who was told by his guru to preach Krishna consciousness in the English language, and he did that, but he did much more also. I mean, he could have just sat in Delhi and given lectures to a few people in English, but he took it as an indication that he should preach Krishna consciousness in the English-speaking world. And then he took it further and took it to the whole world, not just the English-speaking world. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wasn't there to confirm that with, but neither did Srila Prabhupada take permission or guidance from his godbrothers. And in fact, from what we understand, no one was particularly encouraging of Srila Prabhupada, and rather they were discouraging. So you may say, well, he didn't take permission from others. But in this case, he could understand that the desire of his guru, that in itself, or the order of his guru, was the desire of his guru to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, and that, and in he didn't need a confirmation from others who didn't understand that vision or share that vision in the same way that he did. Tar Icha Balavan Paschatyete Tan Tan Hoi Jate Gorangarnam. He described about his own guru. Sri Siddhanta Saraswati Krishna Seva Rati. What is it? Krishna Seva. I don't remember exactly that. Shai Shai Mahanta Guru Jagate Maddeyuru. So he described that his great powerful guru, whose his desire is very strong, and that desire is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's name will spread all over the Western world. So Srila Prabhupada, as Hanuman did, he took the initiative to do more than he was directly ordered to do. Without seeking the confirmation of others, they, both Hanuman and Srila Prabhupada, and there may be so many devotees in so many circumstances who have applied their intelligence and took decisions without the Guru present to personally guide them. But they were, because they're on the platform of Guru Mukha Padma Varka Chitete Koriya Aika Ana Kori Homane Asha, because they'd actually made the decision of the words of their Guru, their life and soul, and not desiring anything else, then they were able to do so with great results. That should not be imitated. That if one thinks, well, I can just do without consulting others. If one is not on that platform, then the results will quite possibly be disastrous if one overestimates one's ability and tries to act on the platform of a fully liberated Vaishnava, but isn't, then yeah, the result is likely to be not the same result that the great Paramahamsas get. By imitating the Paramahamsas, one doesn't get the same effect. Rather, it becomes clear from the results that one is only imitating and not actually following. It tends to become disastrous because Krishna reciprocates with everyone accordingly. If one serves Krishna sincerely according to one's personal level of qualification, then Krishna will reciprocate with, that will be seen how the devotee himself flourishes in Krishna consciousness. Others also flourish. But if one simply imitates, then no one flourishes. Rather, devotees may become discouraged or deviated from the proper path of devotional service. So when one is fully dependent on the Guru, with full faith, then he can act independently in a way that is also not independent. He's not independent in the sense of being defiant, but is using his independence in a way that will fulfill the desire of the Guru. There is, we may say, well, why do we always hear that you shouldn't be so independent, Prabhu? Why do we hear that? Well, maybe you don't hear that nowadays because everyone's independent and no one's. It's hard to find any mood of submission or dependence, and, which is required actually in both in spiritual life and at all if we are to fulfill Srila Prabhupada's desire of spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. There has to be cohesion, authority, hierarchy, submission. All these things are required. If devotees are simply highly independent without actually being very advanced, then they're not going to make advancement. They may think that they're advanced. They may think that they're advanced enough just to decide whatever to do, but usually their decision ends up with them in front of a TV set or taking their dog for a walk. They don't actually advance spiritually, but they sink down to some mundane platform while imagining themselves to be spiritually advanced. Another problem is when someone becomes independent, becomes an independent leader without following anyone, or if they don't have sufficient training. One should be a disciple to get training. In the whole mood of what it means to be a surrendered disciple. And there are many techniques also, spiritual life. Generally devotees, they should be well trained, and then if at all they're going to go out and independently preach, which is required if the Krishna conscious movement is to spread more and more. But first of all, they should know what it means to be a follower before they become a leader. Otherwise, if they're not properly trained and properly purified, then by their independent leadership, they'll cause more problems. So, there are other devotees who are independent by circumstances. It's not that they really want to be, but they might be living in some remote place and they don't have much interaction with devotees. They want to be devotees, but circumstances, the material circumstances they're in, dictate that they're very remote and distant. So it may be difficult for them to make proper advancement because they're more independent than is good for them, or maybe even more than they want to be. Or they may come close to devotees and become dependent on them, those who they are dependent on, those devotees themselves may not be so very well trained or surrendered. So these points should be considered very carefully, what kind of association and guidance we have to take so that we can properly advance. But on the other hand, if we think that, well, there's no proper association or guidance, therefore I won't take any, then again we cheat ourselves. So guidance is required, especially for devotees who are more advanced. They should be able to act in this world in the service of Krishna, which means taking various decisions for which they have they may not have anyone to confirm that with, but if they're, and they may make mistakes in this way also. But if their basic attitude is one of being a servant, not that I don't need anyone to tell me what to do. This kind of attitude, then one may present himself as a very big man and might even become a very big man superficially, but Krishna won't be pleased. So the basic attitude of a devotee is to be submissive, surrendered, humble. Within that basic profile, he may have greater or lesser levels of independence. No one should be independent of the order of the guru, but in the manner of executing it, one may have some leeway. But always one should consider that I am under the authority of guru and gurus, and in this way execute one's spiritual life. Hare Krishna. Is there any question, please? Could you all hear? Okay. Yes, please.
My question is about, sometimes you hear that the future turning of British to West, and that's India. Is it that they follow this in India, but you're not following this in the
West? We follow this in India, but not in the West.
And even if it's a Shastric instruction, they comment this, it looks that they are independent from the
Yeah, well, Srila Prabhupada made many adjustments for the West, there's no doubt, without which he couldn't have spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. He had to modify or ignore many Shastric injunctions, because he found that many people in the West were ready to chant Hare Krishna, which is the essence of spiritual life, but they may not be ready for so many other things. So Srila Prabhupada gave the essence, but and he gave a lot of the culture, but not all of it. So I heard actually from two disciples of Srila Prabhupada who were Indian, born in India, from cultured families, and who went to the West as students and who joined ISKCON in the West. He had two devotees. One is Shubhag Maharaj, and the other is Ram Shraddha. Subhag Maharaj from Calcutta, and Ram Shraddhas from Hyderabad, South India, Tamil, smarter Brahmin family. So Srila Prabhupada said, they both independently said that Srila Prabhupada said to them that you can take spiritual instruction and philosophical guidance from the Western devotees, but don't learn about culture from them. You keep the culture that you learned in your home. So yes, Srila Prabhupada instructed differently. But from what we understand from his many, many references to Indian culture, we understand that he wanted to bring devotees to that level, because it's Indian culture or Vedic culture or Vaishnav culture or Hindu culture that is conducive for spiritual advancement, whereas Western culture is not at all. The other day I was on a plane and I saw this Times newspaper, which is considered a very respectable newspaper of Britain for cultured people. So I saw on one page, actually someone was reading it on their Kindle or whatever, just sitting next to me. On one page it had a page, it was written culture. That means, you know, there are different pages. Culture, sports, well, sports is half the newspaper, and opinion, and things like this. So there was the culture page, culture. And the picture, there was a photo to go with it to show that this is the culture page. And it was a picture of a young woman holding a guitar with her hair scattered all over the place with this rough rock and roll star look on her face. And that is the picture which symbolizes culture for the most cultured newspaper of Britain, which is the most cultured country, right? Not Ireland, for sure. Not even Northern Ireland. That's the myth which the British have successfully propagated. Most people, they themselves believe it. Others in America, they all believe it. And the French don't believe it. The Indians do. But their whole, this is, they think culture is some woman playing guitar and being completely uncultured, and that's culture. So that's just a little, it just gives a little idea how following Indian culture is better for spiritual life. But in other ways it might not be, because if we try to enforce that all at once in the West, then many people may not join, which is the whole principle behind the Krishna West. So both things are there. On one hand, we want to bring this higher culture. On the other hand, we know that most people are not ready for it. So it is a quandary. I just came across this quotation from Transcendental Diary by Hari Shauri Prabhu about Srila Prabhupada in France. This is Transcendental Diary, Volume 3, Chapter 5. A devotee from Germany asked, "Sometimes in our practical dealings we have to make a decision and there is no possibility to refer to our authority. Shall we then try to understand what Krishna wants us to do? Krishna will give you. That is intuition," Prabhupada told him. "If you are actually sincere, the correct intuition will come. Dadami buddhi yogang tang yena mamu payanti. If it is for Krishna's purpose, then he'll give you intelligence. Do like this."
Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jaya.